My assignment tonight is to talk about a navigator history. And generally when I'm asked to talk about navigator history, the person requesting wants to know about navigator ancient history, which is the part that I have been involved in. I feel that the most important part of navigator history is being written today. And you're a part of these exciting chapters. But I'm going to talk mostly about ancient history. Now the format is that I'm going to talk about 10 minutes. In August of 1985, we had a reunion of those who were involved in the early navigator ministry. About 30 hours of those sessions was videotaped. And on the day that the staff here at Glen Eyrie have a chapel service, the reunionees took over the chapel service. And so I'm going to show you a videotape of that one period here. Ancient history. So 10 minutes by way of introduction, about 45 or 50 minutes of videotape, and then about 10 or 12 minutes of question and answers, and then that will end the regimented meeting, and then I'll be around till about midnight for any questions anybody would like to ask me personally. They don't come out in the meetings, and so that meeting is open to anybody who wants to stay up till midnight or less. Now, I first of all would like to ask and answer a question. Why is there a navigator movement today? Why is there a navigator movement from God's standpoint and from man's standpoint? And I'm going to read a sentence from a book on leadership written by a man by the name of Edward Host. One of the most famous overseas missions of the last century was the China Inland Mission, founded by Hudson Taylor. His successor was Edward Host. And so speaking on the subject of leadership, he said, "When God raises up a man for special service, he first works in that man the principles which later on are through his labors and influence to be the means of widespread blessing to the church and the world." Now that's pretty typically British, kind of an unedited sentence, but I think I can break it down into parts as to what Mr. Host was saying. He said that first of all, periodically, God has a desire and a plan to bless the church and the world. He wants to implement a plan that will result in this. So he picks out a man. Now, he said that God is going to bless the world and the church through a principle or principles. So I should have stated that first, that there's a principle. God wants to resurrect or create to bless the church and the world. So he picks out a man to model that principle, which later on will be a blessing to the church and to the world. Who the navigators are and what we do is a little bit difficult to communicate. It's become complicated as the years go by, I think. Back in 1953, I was still in the Navy. The ship I was involved with was stationed in Pearl Harbor. And so my longtime friend, Dawson Trotman, said, "Well, as usual, I want you to be the navigator representative in Hawaii during a time you're there on the ship." And I said, "Well, Dawson, I'm not quite sure I'm qualified. I'm not sure I know exactly what to do." And he said, "What?" And I repeated what I said. I said, "I've been reading, I've been away for a while out at sea, and I've been reading some of the things that's come out from headquarters, and it looks kind of complicated to me." And he said, "It's not complicated. No different than it's ever been." And I said, "Well, tell me, what would you expect me to do as the Navigator representative?" He said, "Do what you've always done, ever since I've known you." I said, "What is that?" He said, "You know what that is." And I had a little difficulty getting it out of him. But finally he came down and he said, "Do what you've always done, lead people to Christ and build them up to where they're able to repeat the process. That's all there is to it." The Navigator vision was never complicated to Dawson Trauma. And so the principle that God wanted to give to the world and the church, and which was modeled by Dawson Trotman, is simply to nourish, bring people to Christ, nourish them to where they can reproduce or repeat the process. That's the bottom line. Dawson Trotman discovered early in his life what was needed to keep his faith and relationship to Christ vital. And he pretty much summarized this in an illustration to which I'm sure that most of you have been exposed, called the wheel illustration. He had a great burden to reach the world with the message God had given him. He knew he couldn't do it by himself. So he regimented the young men, Christian men that he knew, and he laid on them the same disciplines which meant so much to him. But they did not all have the same degree of commitment. I remember Dr. Bob Munger standing here when the lectionary was dedicated, said, "Discipline without desire is drudgery." So some of the fellows that he knew didn't have the desire. So the discipline was drudgery. And one by one, they dropped out of the picture. He was so burdened by what he felt was the failure in the lives of these young men that he didn't know what else to do except to pray. So he asked one of his friends one day, Walt. He said, "Walt, let's you and I get together, pray for these fellows." And Walt says, "Sure, be glad to join you." Don said, "I'll pick you up at 3:30 in the morning." And Walt thought he said 3:30 in the morning. And sure enough, he did. So he picked him up at his motorcycle at 3:30 in the morning. They went down to a little canyon right below Lomita, California, and prayed from 4 to 6. Now, on Sundays, they slept in till 5:30 and then prayed 6 to 10. But their purpose in getting together was to pray for these young men in their group that hadn't continued. Now, I don't know how many times you've been in a prayer meeting where you pray 2 hours every morning, day after day. But, you know, you can cover quite a bit of ground in 2 hours. So after 2 or 3 days, they had prayed everything they could think of for these 5 or 6 people they knew. But the burden didn't lift. So Dawson observed, now there are probably some young men like these we're praying for by name in some neighboring cities. And so they could think of a few names, and they prayed for a few. But pretty soon they had thoroughly saturated that area. But the burden didn't lift. And so they said, "Well, I bet there's some people like this up in Northern California that we don't know about." They prayed for them. "Hey, I bet there are people like this in neighboring states." So before long, they had prayed for young men and young women in all of the then 48 states, but the burden didn't lift. the last week of this six-week prayer meeting, they took a map of the world, and every morning, as they prayed for people from the states, they would also put their finger on cities and countries around the world and pray that God would raise up in these places young men and women who could lead others to Christ, build them up to where they could repeat the process. After about 6 weeks of praying 2 hours every day and 4 hours on Sunday, the burden seemed to lift. The next significant event that happened was Dawson Troutman met a sailor aboard the USS West Virginia, and you're going to meet him by videotape tonight. And for the first time in his life in ministry, Dawson Troutman found a young man that had a heart like he had, and he bought the whole package and said, "This is what I want. Whatever it takes to make me like you, I'm available." Pretty soon, there were sailors from various ships coming over to Dawson Troutman's house. Now, in order to establish a relationship, Dawson Troutman, anybody came over, he had a clipboard, and he had everybody write their name, their home address, and their military address, and their birthday. So he'd have an excuse to follow them up on their birthday. Well, I had a lot of fun, too, and I always put down my birthday was February 30th. So I never did get a card from him on that. But after a while, he had accumulated quite a few sheets. So one day, he was going to dispose of them. He said, "I wonder how many states have been represented." And he went through these sheets on the clipboard and found out that men from every one of the 50 states, or 40 states, 48 states, had been in his living room being taught the word. And in one of his tapes, he says that people from each one of the 48 states came to Christ in his living room. Now, it doesn't take too much smarts to put two things together here, does it? 6 weeks, they prayed for men in every state. And then God brought men every state into his living room. Well, the first fellow that came was named Lester Spencer. And then another fellow named Gurney Harris was second. And then there was Ed Goodrick and John Dedrick. And then there was Virgil Hook and a man by the name of Jim Downing that came along. As I mentioned, we had a reunion here in 85, August of 85. Some of these original people are in their 80s, some in their 70s, and all the rest in their 60s. Now, this videotape you're going to see, you'll readily notice that it wasn't rehearsed or planned. I simply asked them to be here in this room, and they'd be called on, some would be introduced. So what you're going to see on tape is what came out of that meeting. I think in the after discussion, you'll see why I feel that this is a very good presentation of the foundation of Navigator Ministry. So that's all I'm going to say. So if you're ready, why, let's see, there's a monitor on each side so you can exercise your neck and find out which is the easiest to spot.
Something we'll hear about this afternoon. So before Jim comes, let me just commit the time to the Lord. Lord, you know that a little one can become a thousand. And as Dawson prayed and claimed promises, this has come true in our own ministry and in the lives of many. Lord, help us to see and widen our vision of what you can do in individuals' lives as they reproduce themselves into others. Teach us in this hour, and we just pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, Jim.
Thank you, Pat. We appreciate being able to join in this chapel hour with you. How many of you that are here today were here 2 years ago at the chapel service? Well, you'll meet some of the same people, but the message is not going to be exactly the same. We have some here that we did not have 2 years ago, and I'd like to call first on Margie Gould to come up here and join me. From the time that Dawson got started until about 1939, he did not have a full-time secretary. Margie, I asked Pat how many of these work over in the office, and he said about 170. So, for about 2 years, Margie did for the Navigators that which has grown into all that you're doing today. So, how would you like to have the workload today, at least, Margie? So, it was a real honor just to present. We want to see several people. Marge, if you got a speech ready, I didn't ask you to prepare one, so we won't ask you. We just want everybody to see Margie Gould. And I want to ask a very embarrassing question here at this point, too. How many of you have read this book, Doss?
I'm in there.
Well, the rest of you will find a lot of great information about these folks you're going to meet today in here. So we don't have time to print it all today. Do the follow-up in here. Thank you, Margie. And I would like to say at this point that those who are going to appear before you have just been asked to be here, and none has been given any warning about what their parts do. So when I ask them, that'll be the first clue as to how they're supposed to participate. Vivian. This is Vivian Fusby Waters. And Vivian, you became Dawson's secretary what year?
1939.
Until?
Until 45.
Until 1945. Dawson's personal secretary, and now I know that these folks are very productive, but I expect that you turned out as much work during that time as any three of them are turning out. What a privilege that Vivian has had to have been Dawson's personal secretary and the only staff member for part of that time.
Well, Jim... Jim
Hayden. Yeah, we're going to get Jim up here in just a minute. But were you the? He came on staff at also 1939. So there are about three of you that were carrying the work. Well, thank you very much, Vivian.
Okay.
Now I'd like to call on next the other part of the Waters family, and Kim Waters, I believe, has had a greater variety of experience with the Navigators than any of the rest of us that are here, having been a part of the ministry and leading the ministry on how many ships?
West Virginia, and then New Mex, and then Maryland.
And after that, he was on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief at AIA, Commander-in-Chief's headquarters, and one of the most productive ministries of the Navigators during all of World War II was that AIA class. And there's a large contingent of people that came out of that class that are here today. Now, Kenny, you didn't have any warning, but I think the meeting wouldn't be complete here unless we had scripture reading. And I don't have my Bible, and I don't think you have yours, so you're just going to have to do the best you can. So,
well, there's a lot of passages we could use, but maybe the one we use this morning, which is excerpts from Hebrews. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. I'm not just saying this to say it. I'm saying it because it grips our hearts. Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to those things which we have heard, lest by any means we should let them slip. For how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by those who heard him? Somebody start 4:1 for me. I'm blank. Hebrews 4:1. Let us therefore fear, is it? Somebody, all you guys out there, how does Hebrews 4:1 start? I'm tongue-tied. Stop for the first time. Let us therefore fear, lest any promise of entering into his rest, that any of us should come short of it. For the good news was preached unto us as well as unto them, but it did not profit them, because it was not mixed with faith by those who heard it. Today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts. By faith, Noah, when he was warned, moved with fear. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed and went out. That's all I had this morning, so that's enough. You folks scared me.
Aren't you glad? Now, you other folks that haven't had any warning, you can get prepared here a little bit, baby. Two things I wanted to ask you about. Where were you when the attack of Pearl Harbor began?
I was with Jim Downing and a few others up in Kalihi Valley. And I remember Jim's comment says, this can't be the Army practicing because they shoot too fast. Anyway, we jumped in the car and we went down while the second wave was coming in. And I don't know how Jim felt and some of the others, but I felt a little devastated when I saw the Arizona in bellows of smoke and the Oklahoma capsized and fire over the harbor. There we were.
Yes, you said two things. We haven't rehearsed this, and I wonder if you remember them. I remember them. To get to our ship, which was already almost down the bottom, we had to go over to Ford Island. We went on a little boat dock, and I don't remember how we got on the ship, but I had Bible, a notebook, and you had a Bible and several notebooks. And do you remember what happened then?
You told me two years ago. Something about, I guess we'll need two hands?
That's what Kenny says. Well, it looks like we're going to need both hands. There were wounded to be taken care of and people we didn't know. So there was a fire extinguisher in a little wooden shack on the pier there, and we put our Bibles and notebooks, get on with both hands. You said one other thing, too.
You have to tell me that one, but I'll tell you one other experience. Go ahead.
Okay. Kenny said, I'm glad that I'm caught up on my praying so we can go to work.
And by the way, just another thing, when I did come up over the forecastle of the Maryland, a guy grabbed me and says, Waters, pray for me. Well, it wasn't exactly time for a prayer meeting, but what I was going to say, we were on the landing there waiting for a boat, and the Japanese had come diving down, dropping their bombs, and they came around and strafed. You know what strafing is? So, and here we had on these clean whites. Things are so embedded in you that I dropped on the ground and I held myself up so I wouldn't get my whites dirty. By midnight that night, there were one glob of oil. So I wouldn't. It's just one of those instinctive things you do.
I see. Is Gordon Gustafson in the room here? Did Gordon come up?
You.
He was on the Tennessee next to us. And I had the same kind of a reaction. I was worried about my wristwatch getting full of fuel oil. You know, that everything you touched, it was up to her knees and about this deep. So I couldn't get on with it till I got off my watch and gave it to Gordon to keep from it for me until after it was over. Jim Hayden, would you come up? Jim was Dawson Troutman's first assistant and his first male assistant. So at the time, Jim, that you and Margie worked for DOS, the three of you were the Navigator Administration. Is that right?
Right.
And how long were you with Dawson?
1939 to 1950.
And then I asked Lauren last night if he and Jim overlapped. So Lauren was the next one to come. Then there were four. So there's a little bit of overlap before Jim and his wife went on to do other things. What other things did you do while you were with the Navigators?
Oh, we did lots of Bible club work and lots of speaking and traveling. We had Navigator homes in very short periods of time in San Diego and in Long Beach. But then I was the treasurer and had to handle the money. Of course, our budget there for a year might last a day. I don't know.
Who's here from the receipting department? About how much money comes in every day? Is that a secret? Is that...
$3 million a month.
We could have handled that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jim. And is Tordy here? This is Jim's wife, Tordy. We're going to come back to the Foundation 4 or 5 in just a minute. But I want to call up now one of the men that was aboard one of the sister ships, the Colorado. And so, Wayne, would you come on up?
First two up here were easy. I thought we were really going to get by with it.
I'm just going to ask you two or three questions,
okay.
Wayne. Where were you serving when you became a Christian?
USS ship, Colorado?
Yes. Sister ship, West Virginia, Maryland. All three of them
right.
were similar. And Wayne has spent most of his life up to this point after getting out of the Navy with Wycliffe translators. And just about 1 year ago, he had a very privileged experience. And that was to go into a tribe that he was the first white man who ever survived any contact with these people. And Wayne, I just want to ask you a couple of questions. How did you get up to where that tribe was located?
Dug out canoe with a Briggs & Stratton motor and a homemade tail, 5 days on the river, and then 8 hours walking upstream.
And this is in Peru, by the way, the jungles of Peru. Now, I'm really interested in what you found out about the diet of these Indians to which you went.
I think that's a loaded question. I have traveled all over Peru and know every tribe in Peru, and this is the most primitive group that we have ever met, and we just got hold of them last July. When I traveled with them, we arrived at this house and had supper. It was a howler monkey. They're about this long, red, not too good eating. There's lots of monkey that's really delicious. And they warmed him. They do not eat cooked meat. They warmed him, and then they ate the whole monkey from the hair right on through to the intestines, leaving a few bones.
Okay, just one other question about that tribe. I think you said, Wayne, that you'd brought some granola bars along.
No, I didn't. I had a handful of granola for breakfast, and this was at 6 o'clock at night. Breakfast was at 7 o'clock in the morning. We had nothing else between.
Okay, now, God had opened their hearts to the gospel. What happened after this? Some of them were led to Christ. The next trip in, you brought somebody with you, I think you said?
Oh, no, we're a little mixed there. But after that, I sent up some other folks because of sickness. And one man who was apparently dying but lived, through one of our missionaries who could speak a native another dialect, was able to tell him that God loved him and that Jesus would save him. And that day, he accepted Christ, and he has lived. And in that month of severe sickness where 25 did die, five of those people who had killed every person they've ever seen came to know Christ.
Okay, great. You can see what a fantastic time we've been having after most of us not having seen each other for more than 40 years, getting together and reminiscing. Thank you, Wayne.
He's not done with me yet. I'm going to tell you one thing more. Okay. You know, Ken Waters read the scripture this morning, and one of the most thrilling things that I ever saw among the Machiginga Indians, where we translated the New Testament, and was sitting in a little grass roof schoolhouse one day, and this man, 50 years old, had become a Christian 2 years earlier, stood up there and had five people read a passage in John, and then he stood there and reread the whole thing and added the rest of it and preached with the closed New Testament in his hands. It's wonderful what God can do.
Roy Robertson. Roy is no stranger. Maybe on the Navigators, that whether it's a book or a brochure or a slide presentation, Roy is always in there as the Navigators' first missionary who went to China in 1949. Roy has just returned from a trip in China just 2 weeks ago, and at age 64, he led a group of 15 students on a bicycle trip all summer, and they averaged about 50 miles a day, is what he said the other day. So, Roy, what was your purpose in going into China?
My purpose in going into China was I wanted to see it myself, and I wanted some cover. So I thought with college students, that'd be a perfect cover for an old veteran missionary like me going in, and it turned out to be that. Then also we wanted to challenge these students to go to the mission field. And we prayed that at least 50% of them would give their lives to missions as a result of this trip. And third, we wanted to lead souls to Christ.
Now, how long has it been since you had left China until you went back this time?
I left Thanksgiving in 1950 after being under the communists for a year and a half in Shanghai.
And what was the observation after being gone 36 years?
When we bicycled into Canton, after you got by some of the hotels or something like that, it looked like that 35 years had gone and is exactly the same as it was before. The shops, the language, the people, the way the women talk, the customs and everything, somebody had forgotten to turn the clock.
And you attribute that to, you mentioned the other day that communism is not necessarily progressive, is it?
I believe that the communists have failed to brainwash the people against God, basically. That in the scripture, of course, it says that Romans 1:19, that there's a consciousness of God in the heart of every man, because God has made him like that and showed him the presence of God. And so we're 15 people, and we went boldly to witness and use a bridge tract, and very seldom would people challenge us or things like this. They seem eager and interested to learn more about God. Not that they know a lot about him, but there was a hunger and a thirst, I believe, that exists, more so than when I was in Shanghai 36 years ago.
And how many, numbers are not that important, but did you have a response?
We had 45 people after presenting the bridge. Incidentally, I taught them a few words of Chinese, how shall she, that's the good news, and ni fan zui, your sinner, shang xin yesu, believe in Jesus, and they would follow the pictures. One picture's worth a thousand words. So we had a 5,000 word tract. That is, we had five pictures. And they would go through this. You start with two people. You have 10 around you and all around like this. And then we try to narrow it down to one or two. We had 45 who gave their names. We exchanged names and said, yes, I believe. Category one. We had 35 more who seemed quite interested, but we weren't quite sure of where they stood.
And all you told us the other morning about the one city where you created a riot, that I heard Anthony Zioli say that when he preached the gospel, he wanted to see a revival, a riot, or a revolution.
Well, we had eager people in our team, and so we kept going further and further and further in. We didn't have any guides, didn't have any white-shirted people, the secret police. They either wear a white shirt or a white coat. Everybody can see them. They didn't follow us on our bicycles, of course. They're too lazy for that. So we went to villages, went further and further and further and further in, till we finally got to a place where, when we tried to check in the hotel, they said, you can't check in here. You're in forbidden territory. And furthermore, we told our people not to witness, but of course you were out witnessing. So they grabbed one of the tracks and like this and say, well, tomorrow morning we're going to provide transportation for you out of our city. So we were escorted to another place, but 2 days later we're witnessing again. We lost our tail.
Yes, there's one other thing that interested me as I heard you tell that, and the crowds that saw the police apprehending you, which side were they on?
They were on our side. We had a doctor named Dr. Jung, and he treated several members of our team. They have touring places where their medicine, you know, they have a Red Cross. Red Cross means this is a place where you can go for medical help. So he told me, oh, these people are bad. No, they're doing a wrong thing. You're good and they're bad, he said. And he worked for the communists. He's one of their official doctors. And the people around, when they came up with a sidecar, motorcycle and a sidecar, and made their siren, so everybody parted while they came in. And then after they got in, everybody rushed, you know, to about 200 people in front of the hotel looking. And they were definitely on our side. They were very friendly to us, very courteous. They waved and all when we left under guard and smiled. And we hope to go back to the city again.
Yes, we've covered some of the humorous things here, but I'm sure what Roy is conveying behind is that there's open hearts over there for the message.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. John Prince, where is John? I see him back here. Well, I thought I saw him back the back here. So we'll wait for him. Don Rosenberger. Now, this is going to be a real challenge to ask Don questions that I can get a one-sentence reply out of.
Won't be easy.
But we'll try.
Okay.
I think Don had one of the most fascinating assignments that anybody of the Navigators has ever had. And Don, a few years after you had had this interesting assignment, Lorne and I was going to make a trip up to Minneapolis, and he took out a staff list and said, let's see how many of our staff came out of that ministry. And we counted 29. So he said, well, you go to the dean of the school and thank him for providing those 29 staff members. So what was that assignment?
In 1949, Dawson had communicated with Billy Graham, the president of Northwestern Schools, who had asked Doss to send someone to teach courses of navigator emphasis at Northwestern Schools in Minneapolis.
Now, did you hold formal classes in this?
We had one course in scripture memory. Would you believe that? Which was a two-hour course for one semester. We had one course in Bible study, which was for one semester, 3 credit hours. And then we had a course which was called follow-up in the catalog, which consisted of a two-semester course, 3 hours each semester.
How many students do you have per class?
Actually, the classes were very popular, and it would be difficult for me to... there were different numbers in the different classes, but I would say the average in the vicinity around 75 to 100 and a quarter.
Okay, now, just off the top of your head, who are some of the people that are on the Navigator staff today or have been that were in those classes?
Can I correct that just a little bit to say this also? There were in Minneapolis at that time fellows who had come to Minneapolis to participate in what was more generally the Navigator ministry there and who were active in other universities. And many of the fellows who are very active in the work today were in that category and not necessarily as students. But Walden Scott was one of those students. Leroy Imes was one of those students in Northwestern Schools. But Bob Seifert, who is the director of the Navigators in Dallas, Texas, was our contact for the University of Minnesota. Interesting thing about this, we saw several hundred young people find Christ over the period of a couple of years there. And when this began to occur like popcorn, Bob Seifert had a very unusual kind of experience. Can I take 1 minute and tell you about it? You know the verse, Matthew 4:19, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. The incredible thing was, this handsome young guy, who is a straight arrow, I mean to tell you, but this handsome young fellow couldn't win anything to the Lord but women. The girls were coming to Christ like this all over the place. So we revised the scripture, and Matthew 4:19a says, follow me and I'll make you fishers of women.
Do you remember one of your students named Roy Cook?
Very well.
Roy Cook was one of Don's students for a while, and I don't know what else he learned. But the one thing that seemed to really burn in his heart was, where's your man? So he didn't know anybody in Minneapolis, but he knew a man who worked in a bank back in Oregon by the name of Doug Coe. So Roy Cook dropped out of school, went back, got hold of Doug Coe, and brought him back and enrolled him. Now, Doug was probably not a Christian at that time, so he didn't last too long. So when he went back to Oregon, Roy Cook, instead of continuing, went back. Doug Coe today, after being a staff member of the Navigators many years, is no doubt the most influential Christian man in all Washington, D.C., and in many countries of the world. And it was Roy Cook to Doug.
You can see Doug Coe's picture in Chuck Colson's book, Born Again. Because he was very active in the initial contacts with Chuck Colson, as well as with a number of people who have been involved in difficult times there in Washington, D.C. The National Prayer Breakfast for the President, which meets in February of each year in Washington, D.C., is a function of the activity in the ministry of which Doug Coe is the head there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The last 2 years I lived in Washington. We were neighbors of Doug the last 2 years in Washington, and I was thankful every day for that chain of circumstances. Now, I don't even have my own script here, but since we have you folks that are here, at the time Charles Colson was being sentenced to prison, I had a call one day from two girls that worked in the shipping department. That's when shipping department was down in the barn. And they said, the Lord has laid on our heart to send him some material. How do we get it to him? I said, well, I'm sure the first day he's in jail, he will be visited by Doug Coe. So I gave him Doug's address. They sent the material. As I was reading Born Again, you remember the account? He said, my first visitor was Doug Coe, and he brought with him some Navigator materials. I was sitting next to Chuck Colson at a banquet sometime one evening, and it happened there were two of us on the right. Chuck was in this position, and then three other people over here, so he couldn't talk to anybody but me during that preliminary. So after he found out I was from the Navigators, he said, I do not believe that in the book I gave the proper credit to what the Navigators have done for me. He said, those materials that Doug brought did more than anything else to build me up and to help me and sustain my Christian life while in jail. So that was all a result of the Lord laying on the hearts of two girls that worked in shipping to get those materials to him. Okay, I see John Prince is here, and Harold Lindenmeyer. Now, I'm not going to ask you guys to say anything, but I want you to come on up and stand in front here. And let's see. John, would you stand over here on the right? And Lindy on the left. You know, come in a little closer. And I'd like to know if you see any resemblance. On page, 124 in DOS, there's a picture of six sailors taken in 1937, and 37 years. How many? 37 to 7 from to date. How many years is that? 37 from 46, isn't it? This what year is this? 55, 85. 38 years later, I just wanted you to see three of the people that were in this picture. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I'm sorry we don't have time for you to preach. Now, could we be joined up here with Les Spencer, Ed Goodrick, John Dedrick, and Virgil Hook? And I don't know how we're all going to get around here. Why don't a couple of you get up here and then...
Stay down, the rest of you...
Now, some of you heard Les Spencer 2 years ago, and just two questions I want to ask you, Les. And first of all, I want to see whether this is real. He's got a real right arm here. Did you actually tell Dawson Topman you would give your right arm if you could do what you'd have seen him do as he witnessed to this watchman, policeman?
Yes.
And what was his response?
Well, he led me on for a while, sort of bantering me. Oh, you wouldn't do that, you know. And that went on while we walked up the driveway, comma. This is one sentence, you know, and this is a comma.
Okay. What happened next?
We got back to the car that we were... riding in, and so Doss finally said, well, Les, he said, you know, if you really mean business, you can do what I was doing and still keep your right arm. And I said to him, what do you have in mind? He had plenty in mind, I can tell you.
Okay, now another quotation that is attributed to you is that when you took Gurney Harris to see Dawson, you said to Dawson, well, what did you say to him?
Well, he... I said to Dawson when Gurney Harris came over, I said, tell this fellow what you've been telling me. And he'd been discipling me. And I had a desire to see Gurney get in on all those good things, too. And so that's what he...
He didn't say, you teach him.
Yes.
Oh, he did. Okay.
That's what he said.
Yeah. Okay, that'd be my next question. Okay, that's what you said. Now, what did he say?
He said, you teach him.
And what did you say?
And I said, well, Doss, I don't know how.
And what did he say?
He said something to the effect, he said, if you can't tell him what I told you, I failed. And he, furthermore, he said, I'll help you.
Okay, we're setting the record straight on those two conversations. Now, several times in this conference, these four people up here have been referred to as the foundational four. Actually, it was the foundational five, because Gurney Harris. To whom Les just referred, is with the Lord.
Good.
So we won't call you the four, but the five.
Good.
Okay, we're not in this sequence here now, but Virgil Hook, you spent how many years in Tibet?
About 10 years working among the Tibetan people.
Yes, now you had a very special privilege that enabled you to get around without the authorities interfering with you. What was that?
It was my Tibetan name.
Tell us about it. You can have a paragraph.
I have been taken from the, or with the head of the CNMA missionary group over to visit a head living Buddha in the monastery there. And I did a few magic tricks and played my little mouth harp for him, and he was quite pleased with me. So he asked me if I had a Tibetan name. I said, no. He said, well, how would it be if I gave you one? Fine. So he gave me the name Lobsang Trashi. Then going around as people would ask, what's your name? I said, Lobsang Trashi. And I said, well, where'd you get a name like that? Because no Tibetan would ever give their child that name. It sort of includes like a doctor's degree along with it. And so, oh, Alef Jayun Japa gave it to me. Oh, you know him. That sort of opens his mouth.
So, if you ever given any opposition, all you had to do is to get your name.
Just let my name be known.
Now, Virgil told us the other day that he almost had a Tibetan wife given to him. Tell us about that incident.
I've been visiting a monastery and giving out tracts and all, and it was festival time, and at festival times only are women allowed in the monasteries. Otherwise, donkeys and women are not allowed in the monasteries. And as I was leaving, a lady and her daughter were walking along, and they talked a little bit with me, and then this lady said, are you married? I said, no. And she said, well, then you'd like to have my daughter, wouldn't you? And I said, well, you know, she was a right attractive-looking young lady. I couldn't really say no, but so I said, well, can she read? And the lady said, no, she can't read. So I said, well, I'd like to have a wife that can read.
Okay, Ed, you've read in the scripture many times. I'm not talking to Adam, talk to the rest of you, from Dan to Beersheba. What's the significance of from Dan to Beersheba?
It's the normal way of expressing the northern and southernmost limits of the Holy Land, the land of promise.
How many miles is that from Dan to Beersheba?
It's 150 miles as the crow flies.
Now, you decided a few years ago that you wanted to make the trip from Dan to Beersheba. Is that right?
That's right, I did.
And you made the trip.
And I made the trip.
And how did you make the trip?
I walked. I wanted to know what it was like to have the feel of the distances that the biblical characters had. And the only way to do that is to walk when they walked. And so I decided I'd walk from Dan to Beersheba. I wanted some of the comforts of civilization, so I wanted to have a little camping equipment and some textbooks and some photography equipment, and I couldn't carry all that, so I bought me a donkey at just above Dan on Mount Hermon. If it would have been, I planned if it was going to be a girl, it would be Beersheba, and if it was a boy, it's going to be Dan. And they showed me a lovely one that could be named Beersheba, but she was terribly pregnant. And I just couldn't conceive myself of being a midwife to a donkey somewhere out in the Netherlands. I asked if there wasn't a Dan available.
Now, was this donkey that carried your pack and camp equipment real cooperative?
No, I think it was mainly my fault. You have to learn how to drive a donkey as much as learn how to drive a car. And I tried to get it in high gear, but I never found a slot for it. I tried and tried one time. A little boy about 10 years old saw my plight, and he got behind that donkey, and he said those magic words, and all day long, that donkey walked in high gear. And I tried to mimic his voice and tried to mimic his voice, and I couldn't fool the donkey. He knew.
What years were that you went made that trip?
That was in 67.
Huh. Well, I hope these older navigators are an inspiration. When you're 64, you go bicycling in China. When you're not that quite old, you take a hike from Dan to Beersheba. John, can we have you from the back? I've got one final question to ask each one of you here.
Okay. All right, but I think if I could take a vote with the others, and if Gurney were here, I don't think we would settle for the first five. I really don't. I'd settle for the first six. And I think
somebody else is going to have to say this. As much as I respect John and Bernie Gurney and Les and Cook, I think as far as setting the tone of the navigators, you've made more of a contribution than any other one of us, and that's for the record. Ed became a professor of Greek and Hebrew after serving a short time in the pastorate. I expect that many of you in this room have benefited from the complete concordance on the New International Version of the New Testament. And you'll notice that the compiler of that, Edward W. Goodrich, that you have here before you. John? A part of the Foundation 5, John Dedrick. Now, by profession, John was a radioman. Somehow you got interested in celestial navigation. How did you get interested in celestial navigation?
No, I joined the Navy specifically. I'd investigated in the recruiting station in Houston, Texas. I lived in Weimar, which is 100 miles to the west. My dad took me in specifically because we knew when I was getting out of high school we wouldn't have the funds to send me to college. We went and checked on the Navy to see what they had to offer, and we found out that they had two things to offer. One was what they called a Naval Academy Preparation Class, and they had a whole list of trade schools, electric and bugle school and music and who knows what else, and they had a radio school. But I joined the Navy. I thought I'll gamble 4 years of my life against a chance to get into this Naval Academy preparation class. That's the basic reason that I joined the Navy in June 1929. I went to Houston. Well, in fact, I went to investigate and went back home and then later joined. But I thought if worse comes to worse, radio was an oncoming thing, and that fascinated me. I thought, well, if I don't make the Naval Academy preparation class, I'll take radio school. So I went on out and joined the Navy and went on out, went through the basic training that all of us have to take, and I qualified in a respect for the Naval Academy preparation class. And they had us all up there ready, and they were... Well, the first thing they did was a physical examination, and they started our toes, toenails, you name it. I never had an examination eyelid. They weren't taking anything that was bone spavin or swayed back or you know what. And I don't know, that exam was about 3 hours, physical exam. And they worked up, and they left nothing untouched. And the last thing he looked at was my eye, and he blew his top. I'm blind in one eye. I'd fallen on a stick when I was a kid, and he said, blind people, how did you even get in the Navy?
On the navigation thing
okay,
here.
Okay, that's it. That's getting right into that. Then I took radio school. We were getting right there. I took radio school, but after I got out, I thought, well, I can't make a commission through the Naval Academy, but I'll work on my own and try to come up through the ranks. So I started studying navigation.
Yeah, and you met Dawson Troutman during that period.
And that was the period I met Dawson.
Did you ever discuss with him the use of the sextant, star sights?
Yes, I was very fascinated with navigation.
And you explained, you actually taught him how to take star sights.
What I had learned, how to take sights, how to, spherical trigonometry is what it is. It's very simple. The celestial sphere. In fact, that's what had gotten me, I became an atheist because of the study of I could not conceive that there could be any being as tremendous as this universe when you study it even from the celestial navigation point of view, because every star is a fixed point out there that you work on. And I can explain the theory, but we don't want to go in that.
No.
Okay.
But Dawson Troutman was fascinated. Many of these, Virgil and Lester, met Mrs. Rittenhouse in San Diego before they met Dawson Troutman, and she had what was called a Servicemen's Bible Club. So when Dawson Troutman thought that there was enough interest to attach a name to what was going on, he asked her if they could call this Servicemen's Club Number 2. But Mrs. Rittenhouse, I think, did not have that much confidence in how
it was. Milo Jameson had his radio Bible class, and that was what they didn't want. They weren't anxious for him to use this Bible class idea. Milo Jameson, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right, John.
It was Milo Jameson.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't Mother Rittenhouse.
No. Yeah, all right.
Okay.
Now, got the record straight.
Huh? Okay.
But Dawson Trotman was looking for a name. And as he talked with John and saw what celestial navigation is all about, moving from one place to the other.
Find a new way.
Yeah, it occurred to him, you know, this is what everybody's doing. And without a chart and a guide and a section and everything, you never make it. So it was out of Dawson Trotman's conversations with John Dedrick that the name Navigators came into being.
We didn't know then.
Yeah. John, you have spent how many years of your life in Mexico?
Well, I spent actually 37 there.
And your tribe is?
The Yaqui Indian tribe, northwestern Mexico.
How many people in the tribe?
Between 15,000 and 20,000.
And how many of them are Christians today?
6 trying to work with the Yaquis. And that includes Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, and they are divisive, competitive, and they are sowing pure confusion, plus the fact that we're getting unbelievable competition from, opposition from radical Marxists.
Okay, well, our time is about up. I figured out how much this hour is going to cost in the payroll. An estimate would be about $2,000 worth of time that we've used here, so we need to bring to a close. But I want to ask each one of these men up here just one question of the Navigator basics. That is, let's say there's 4 points, and we won't talk about the Christ-centeredness, but the word, prayer, witnessing, and fellowship. Which one of those, and in the word we include memory, of those basics has been the most vital to you in these last 45 years? Ed?
I'd have to say from the top of my head the word.
Okay.
Same. I hate to separate them, but if you have to say, I'd hate to even draw the line. But yes, Scripture. When God talks, that's it.
Okay.
I agree.
I too. I'd say the word.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Our time is up. We really appreciate being with you. Well, was that last part worth waiting for? Those of you that are familiar with Navigator background know that it was these first 4 men that Dawson Trotman worked with. First, Lester Spencer. The second, Gurney Harris, who was not in the picture. He's with the Lord. And then the next two that came along were John Dedrick and Ed Goodrick. And there they are today. And as we got together, if somebody ask for a description of these reunionees, some in their 80s, 70s, nobody that wasn't in their 60s. The observation I made was that there was not a single one of these white-haired warriors that is weary of the battle. Some of them may be weary in it, but not of it. Now, first of all, I realize that it was pretty long and strung out. You see, it wasn't rehearsed. We're just trying to introduce these people to the staff here at the Glen. But are there any observations that you've made from watching us about the Navigator beginnings or the Navigators as they are today? Did you think it was significant when these 4 were asked, what has been the most significant to you in the last 45 years, they were all united. And what was it? Yes. Some of you probably wonder why some of these people didn't become staff the Navigators. Dawson Trotman did not want to build an organization. And so it was not until after 1945 that he would accept anybody on staff instead everybody was channeled to some other Christian group to work with. And about the first 400 people that came out of the Navigator Military Ministry went to foreign mission organizations. Wycliffe, I think, had the most. Wayne Snell, that you saw, was just one of many who went with Wycliffe. Okay, well, I made one observation now, that any of you have an observation to make. Yes. Stand up, please. So,
this is the vision of where's your man, where's your woman, isn't a bunch of hype and a bunch of talk, that it really works. And each one of them is committed to doing that in their own life.
Okay. Anybody else? That's okay.
I think that even though you asked me about those past, you know, past orders, that they were still talking about the ministry today, and they were waiting for today, and they weren't just hiding away from that.
Okay. Yes. You're great. Yes.
One thing, sometimes the ministry is complicated. You know, I think we shared off earlier, and the thing that came out of me was, you know, start off simple.
In those early years, what Dawson Troutman was doing at those first four you saw, he was a disciple maker making disciples, but it never got that label until about 1950. And somehow I think the labels we pin on it makes it more complicated. Okay, anybody else have an observation?
I know you can't tell if you're going to be a mover of God's kingdom by looking at it. You're going to end up being somebody that God's going to take somewhere and really do a big work with. You work with the ones that God gives you.
Yes, well, history could be written up a book on most of these people. You see, you know, Ed probably has the most international prominence. But, you know, Kenny Waters, you know, he's all made their mark in the Christian world. Okay, anybody else? Observation here? Yes.
Well, I think we're hearing a lot today about how the elderly in the States are disregarded as the lost generation. And as I was watching these men and how much spunk they had, I thought, well, I hope that when I get to be that age, I still have that kind of desire to get out and do something. And so I was really impressed. And I thought about the passage where he talked about how that will take you to your grave and full vigor. And it really came out with me.
I spent several days up in Portland this last year and stayed with Ed, my old buddy from the Navy, 1932. And he has been commissioned by Zondervan to prepare seven concordances. So he's down there every day, two research assistants and a computer going strong on preparing the others. Just one, three have been finished, but he's working on four more here. And he's the same age I am. Yes.
I have a question rather than observation. Of those original people that Dawson brought in, began to pray for who had fallen away, what was the result of that prayer? Was there any of those that came back to faith or come back to the
Yes, and about three of them were on our reunion list of the six, the five or six that they prayed for the most, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's the next stage here. I asked for observations. I was going to ask for questions, so that's the first one. Anybody else have a question? Yes.
Is it true that Trautman memorized a verse a day for 1,000 days?
I'm not sure his exact what his quota was, but this would be a good opportunity to hold up this book and say there's a lot of detail and good information in this book. And if you really want to know the details of the early navigator history, it's all in this book called DOS by Betty Skinner. And she does comment on that, but I'm not sure the page number, so I can't verify it for you at this point. But he knew a lot of them, I'll tell you that. Yes. Stand up, please. And
the disciplines of the Christian life, sometimes I feel like I'm juggling 4 or 5 different disciplines, like prayer time, remembering, Bible study, witnessing, these sorts of things. And I can see my desire has lessened. I think it's probably lessened some, and also life gets more complex and more things enter in, and you seem to fail in the disciplines. How do you, through the years, have you kept your desire high to continue in the disciplines of the wheel?
Well, I think in my own case that I have tried not to be legalistic. And I sometimes think about the navigator basics, the things in the wheel, the New Testament basics, they could be called. I don't know very much about music, but what I've heard of, you know, it's a matter of timing. You know, the greater the timing, well, the more harmony comes out. Well, when my oldest daughter was taking piano lessons, she took from a classical Hungarian teacher. And after, you know, I used to take her to practice and sit out in the car while she practiced. And after about a year, I said, when are you going to play a tune? Because all I ever heard was this. And she was kind of insulted at that, because before you can play a tune, you have to learn the basics. So what the basics in the Christian life produce is harmony. And that's the result we're looking for, is the harmony in the music, it seems to me. So I don't look at the basics as something legalistic. You know, if I do this, and I do this, and I do this, and I do this, well, I'm all right. I'm looking for the harmony that comes out of the blend. So I think you're exactly right that at different times we major on different ones in order to bring out the harmony. But a person in whose life the basics are visible, it may not be too harmonious, may be more legalistic. So what we're after is the fruit that the basics produce, seems to me. Okay, is there, that is a long answer, not a very good one. Anybody else have a question? Yes. Now, I'm a little hard of hearing, and so you have to speak louder, please.
As I listen to the man and father vision that they have, there's something in me that has a fear that I can't, you know, that vision won't be my own. And I wonder what the best thing that I could do to make that vision my own.
I think as I know these fellows and many more, you know, down through the years, that, let me back up a little bit. I don't know what the occasion was, but, it was, we had a return missionary orientation conference here a few months ago, and they asked me to speak on how to finish well. And maybe that's the way I think of your question, how to finish well. And it seemed to me that the answer is pretty simple, that in Ecclesiastes 8:8, the scripture says that there's no discharge in war. Different translations say different things, that there's no furlough in battle. Some of you folks have been in the military and look forward to the end of your obligated service or to retirement. But in the spiritual warfare, there's no retirement, there's no furlough, there's no vacation. And I think what keeps us going is that we're lifers. You know, when I give my life to Christ, that's for life. It's not something I'm going to do for a while. You know, it's a lifer. And of the people you saw up here, Wayne Snell, I don't know how old he is. He's kept his age well, but he's going back to Ecuador. Every one of these people are still busy. Old John Dedrick could hardly drag himself up here, but he's living on the border close to Mexico. You know, that's his life down there. So that's the first thing I would think of, that this is a lifetime commitment. There's no discharge. There's not even a furlough in the spiritual warfare. And, of course, Paul writing Timothy says that no man that joins the spiritual warfare acts like a civilian. He's only concerned with pleasing his commanding officer. Well, again, I think that was a long and poor answer to a good question. One or two more, then we'll let you go. You've had a long day here. Yes. Yes, you. Uh-huh.
If Dawson Trotman were alive today, what do you think would be the thing that would encourage him most to go out and navigate the mystery? And what do you think he'd be most excited about?
Well, Dawson Trotman was such a strong personality that 15 years after his death, I asked Lauren Senny once, I said, do you have the feeling that Dawson's looking over your shoulder? And he said, last night I dreamed that he was. So there's some people around him that are very conscious of what you just brought up, you know, wondering what he's thinking right now, what's going on. Well, after Lauren Sanney inherited the job from Dawson Trotman after he drowned, many people said, now, if Dawson were alive, he would do this or he'd do that. And Lauren's reply was that I worked closely with him for 15 years, and I never knew what he would be thinking or doing 5 minutes from now. So for you to say, if he were alive, he would do this, which was Lauren's way of saying that he was very progressive. He was very aware of the signs of the times. Dawson has said many times that his ministry was not to a military ministry. It happened to be in that particular age of or point in time that there were more displaced persons in the military service than they were on the college campus. It was not until 1959 that the number of students exceeded the number in the military. He said his ministry was to young people. So as the majority of available were found on the campus instead of the military, the Navigator ministry drifted into that. So to summarize what I think would be the answer to your question, I think Dawson Trotman would be very happy. It's interesting that he did not have a premonition that he was going to die soon, but his wife Lila did. And the day before he drowned, this premonition was so strong that she took a shorthand notebook and took about 4 hours of notes on his observations for the family, the ministry, and so forth. And she has those written down in a notebook. And she's never told anybody what all of them are. But one of the things that she did share was, don't let them make it complicated. You know, I think he foresaw the danger. So I think that he might feel that there are so many, much terminology and so forth, that it's a little difficult to see what the basic thing of the ministry is. So probably that would be one of his warnings. Don't let him make it complicated. Okay, we want to get you out of here a long day, but we'll see one more question or observation or anything anybody wants to say. One other person. Okay.
What was it about the message or the men's life that brought you to Christ?
Yes, I've got just about enough time on the clock to answer that. Virgil Hook, that you saw here, that almost got the Button wife. John Diederich, Ed Goodrich, they explained the theology to me. Virgil Hook lived it. One day I was on a early morning work party with him, and I was got up 3:30 in the morning, had beans and ketchup and cornbread for breakfast, went over to refrigeration ship and heaved sides of beef around all morning. Well, I didn't know that's what I was getting the Navy to do, and I was very unhappy. But in this man, Virgil Hook, I saw that here was a man that outward circumstances couldn't touch. Now, I would say up to that point in my life, any inward happiness I experienced was due to favorable outward circumstances. Outward circumstances, good, I'm happy inside. Outward circumstances, bad, I'm unhappy. Here was a man that circumstances couldn't touch. He had the same joy in adversity as any time else. And I think that was the final thing. The other guys explained the theology. He lived it. He lived it. And I was attracted to his life for that very reason. Okay. Is there somebody has to say something here before we conclude? If you do, we'll let you say it. Okay, we'll turn it back, and thank you very much.